This is Jeff Blankford with the March 22, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Next week happens to be one of those fifth Wednesdays, and so tune in then and have the opportunity then to share your takes on the world with your fellow listeners before Joy LeClaire returns with Forthright Radio on April 5th. A lot is likely to happen before then. While the Democrats and the liberal media punditry remain desperately preoccupied with convincing Americans that their delusion about Russian interference in last November's presidential election has some basis in fact, and congressional committees are aggressively looking into it, something very real and very dangerous that should merit their attention is taking place thousands of miles away. I'm speaking, of course, of the latest crisis between the United States and North Korea, brought about by recent successful North Korean missile tests, the installation by Washington of THAAD missile batteries in South Korea, and the massive annual joint exercises between the U.S. and South Korean militaries, which invariably focus on ways to attack or respond to hypothetical attacks from North Korea. Previous administrations have employed sanctions and diplomatic pressure on China, North Korea's closest neighbor and major trading partner, to tone down the threat of renewed hostilities. According to the New York Times and other mainstream media, the U.S. has previously conducted cyber and electronic warfare against North Korea, and this hacking, considerably more significant and deadly than leaked emails, reportedly caused a number of its missiles to explode. President Trump and his Secretary of State, former Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, with zero experience in diplomacy, have been threatening to break this routine and take military action against Pyongyang's missile sites, a move that most observers agree would ignite a devastating war with casualties at a minimum in the hundreds of thousands. This all has been taking place during the successful impeachment of South Korean President in Korea. It makes the situation almost surreal, given reports that apparently most South Koreans oppose the deployment of THAAD, since it will do nothing to protect them and will, they believe, make them less safe in any conflict with the North. That's what I'll be speaking or exploring about 20 minutes past the hour when I speak with Korean-American journalists Hwin Lee and Julian Cho from Zoom in Korea, an online resource for news and analysis about the developments on the Korean Peninsula. So stay tuned for that. China, of course, always figures large in every crisis between the U.S. and North Korea, and this time around, its leaders do not like what they see and hear from either side. Before Rex Tillerson visited Beijing over the weekend, he first stopped in Seoul, vowing not to repeat previously U.S. efforts to bring the North in line, stating emphatically that the U.S. does not want a military conflict, but, quote, but obviously if North's actions that threaten South Korean forces are our own forces, that would be met with an appropriate response. If they elevate the threat of their weapons program to a level that we believe requires action, that option is on the table, end quote. This and Washington's decision to deploy the THAAD missile system led China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi to say that a war between the United States and North Korea may be inevitable. He said, quote, the two sides are like two accelerating trains coming toward each other. That's what he said at a news conference last week, and he says the question is, are the two sides really ready for a head-on collision? The deployment of South Korea, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, is particularly troubling to China, given remarks the Trump administration has put forth regarding China's defending what it perceives to be its interest in the South China Sea, and Trump having reached out to the president of Taiwan as one of his first acts in office. At the same time, Xinhua, China's state media, warned of, quote, an arms race. It says, more missile shields of one side inevitably bring more nuclear missiles of the opposing side that can break through the missile shield, as according to the Xinhua article. At the press conference, Wang warned South Korea to halt the deployment of THAAD because it threatens China's security. Wang was being diplomatic, obviously being aware the decision regarding the introduction of THAAD to South Korea was made in Washington and not in Seoul. Genuine questions remain to this day about which side initiated the Korean War, but like events of 9/11 or the assassination of President Kennedy, they are not considered fit for public discussion. I was 16 years old in June 1950 when the war began and was already closely following the politics of the Cold War in the mainstream media. Shortly before the Korean War began, I recall reading a long article in the Los Angeles Daily News describing the building up of the South Korean army in glowing terms, that the U.S. had established South Korea's own little West Point and was more than capable of defeating the North Korean army should the situation arise. To refresh my memory, to see if I was misremembering what I had read on a bus that day, and doing some investigation online, it turned out that I hadn't. I found the confirmation and much more in a pamphlet entitled Korea, The Lie That Led to War by Sir John Pratt, an authority on China who held appointments in the British Foreign Service at many places in China and was for 13 years advisor on Far Eastern affairs in the Foreign Office and served for 2 years as head of the Far Eastern section of Britain's Ministry of Information. At dawn on Sunday, 25 June, wrote Pratt, South Korean President Syngman Rhee launched a sudden attack which took the North Koreans by surprise. His forces crossed the 38th parallel at several places and captured Haeju, some miles to the north, on the road to Pyongyang. The North Koreans staged a counteroffensive and the South Koreans threw down their arms and fled. The North Koreans then drove on across the parallel and staged a full-scale invasion of South Korea. For nearly a year, wrote Pratt, both North and South Koreans had been expecting civil war to break out, and each side was confident of victory. The American Military Advisory Group, Pratt writes, who had created the South Korean Army, were convinced that one South Korean division could defeat three North Korean divisions, and Syngman Rhee had often boasted that, if they were allowed to start, his forces could capture Pyongyang, the northern capital, in 3 days. These were ludicrous miscalculations, wrote Pratt. Pratt then quotes U.S. General Douglas MacArthur speaking to the U.S. Senate on May 6, 1951, 10 months after the war started, about what had happened. Said MacArthur, the South Koreans were no match for them at all, and the disposition of the South Koreans of their logistical potential was extraordinarily poor. They had put their supplies and equipment close to the 38th parallel. They hadn't developed any positions in depth. Everything between the 38th parallel and Seoul was their area of depot. When they lost that immediate line, they lost their supplies. They, said MacArthur, meaning the South Korean Army, were not able, apparently, to destroy them en masse, so that at one initial stroke, this North Korean Army had a new supply base in the area between the 38th parallel and Seoul, which enabled them to press south with the full strength of their base being immediately behind them. They no longer had to rely on the long distance from the Yalu River to get their supplies down, end quote. General MacArthur. Pratt also noted that at the time the war broke out, quote, a plan for unifying Korea by conference and negotiations had been launched by the North Koreans and was having such success that President Syngman Rhee's government in South Korea was on the verge of internal collapse, end quote. That was often a report published a year after the war began by longtime British Foreign Service official Sir John Pratt, titled Korea, The Lie That Led to the War. You could find that online. I suggest you read it. In the article's appendices, he cites an article from the New York Times on July 31, 1950, 5 weeks after the start of the war, which reported that a day earlier, an intelligence staff officer at General MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo said that the North Korean army had not carried out its full mobilization plan at the time the war began on 25 June, that only six full divisions had been ready for combat when the invasion started, although the North Korean war plan called for 13 or 15, end quote. Pratt points out that no theory was offered to explain why North Korea should launch an invasion before it was fully ready to do so. Pratt also notes that on August 1, 1950, the New York Times reported that, quote, the Senate voted $2,450,000,000 to carry forward the Marshall Plan for the economic reconstruction of Western Europe, and had warned the 16 beneficiary nations that those refusing to help the United States fight the United Nations, quote, battle in North Korea, might lose all Marshall Plan aid, end quote. And finally, Pratt writes that John Gunther, a major American historical writer of the mid-20th century, was in Tokyo in June 1950, gathering material for his book about General MacArthur. On June 25th, he was lunching with two important members of the U.S. occupation forces when one was called to the phone, that's how Gunther writes it, and came back and whispered to Gunther, a big story has just broken. The South Koreans have attacked North Korea, end quote. It was a short but costly war by Washington's current standards, with almost an entire graduating class from West Point being wiped out because the Pentagon had underestimated the North Koreans' fighting ability. Of the 5,720,000 U.S. troops who served in Korea, 36,995 died. Another 103,200 were wounded. Korean casualties on both sides of the 38th parallel were estimated at close to 3 million. What would another war between the U.S. and South Korea mean? A very grim scenario if it occurs, writes veteran war correspondent and columnist Eric Margolis. Quote, he said, Margolis says, the U.S. has nearly 80,000 military personnel in South Korea and Japan, as well as more war-fighting units in Guam, which the U.S. conquered from Spain in 1898 during the Spanish-American War. The U.S. 7th Fleet patrols the region armed with tactical nuclear weapons. U.S. nukes are also based in South Korea and Guam. As we recently saw, writes Margolis, U.S. heavy B-1 and B-52 bombers can fly from North America to Korea. South Korea, Margolis notes, has a formidable 600,000-man army equipped with state-of-the-art weapons. North Korea's 1-million-manned armed force is large but obsolescent. Its great strength in heavy military partly compensates for its totally obsolete 1960s vintage air force. Key combat elements of the DPRK, that's the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, army are dug deep into the rocky hills just north of the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, with thousands of heavy North Korean guns facing south. In the event of the war, writes Margolis, the North claims it will destroy South Korea's capital, Seoul, that is only 30 kilometers away and has 20 million residents. Well, that's a large estimation. But U.S. estimates of war in Korea made a decade ago suggest America would incur 250,000 casualties in a war that would cost 1 million Korean deaths. That's why the U.S., he says, has shied away from direct attack on North Korea. Unlike Iraqis, Syrians, Libyans, and Somalis, attests Margolis, North Koreans know how to fight back and are amply armed for defensive war. The U.S. would certainly be tempted to use tactical nuclear weapons against North Korean troops and guns deeply dug into the mountainous terrain. Without them, air power, America's usual trump card, would lose much of its destructive potential. No doubt, all North Korea would be ravaged by U.S. air power as it was during the 50s Korean War. South Korean plans, writes Margolis, plans massive air, missile, and commando attacks on North Korean military headquarters and against leader Kim Jong-un's hideaway. U.S. war plans call for amphibious landings along North Korea's long, vulnerable coastline. This threat forces the North to deploy large numbers of regular army and militia troops on both coasts. North Korea's air force and little navy would be vaporized on the first day of hostilities, writes Margolis. But it is likely that the DPRK would be able to fire a score or more of medium-range missiles at Japan. If the war goes nuclear, Japan looks almost certain to suffer nuclear attack along with Guam, Tokyo, and Osaka, their prime targets. North Korean forces, continues Margolis, might be able to push south to Seoul, but likely no further in the face of fierce attacks by U.S. and South Korean air power operating from bases further south. The North's powerful commando force of some 100,000 troops would attack key South Korean targets, including its vital air bases shared with the U.S. Such raids would be highly disruptive but not decisive unless the DPRK uses chemical and/or biological weapons to shut down South Korea's air bases and its ports at Busan and Incheon. The U.S. and South Korea could certainly win such a war, but it would be very bloody and expensive. There would be the threat of Chinese military intervention if it appeared the U.S. was about to occupy North Korea, and Russia is right next door. Secretary Tillerson, Margolis concludes, please leave war threats to the generals and start practicing some active diplomacy with the North. If ever a war was not needed, it's here. And those were the words of Eric Margolis, an award-winning internationally syndicated columnist and veteran war correspondent who has covered wars across Africa and Southeast Asia and doesn't want to see another one in Korea. And it's pretty heavy what I just read to you, but it's time we heard about it before it happens. Thinking about the Korean War reminds me that this was the first time I had heard the word gook, which U.S. soldiers, and particularly the Marines, used to describe Koreans, and recall hearing a respected news commentator on the air, Gabriel Heater, tell his listeners that, quote, one American Marine was better than seven gooks, end quote. While preparing for today's program, I decided to look up the word's origin. H.L. Mencken reported that the earliest use of the word gook was in his book American Language was that Marines, U.S. Marines, occupying Nicaragua in 1912 took to calling the natives gooks and that had previously been used as a term for Filipinos. The first written use was in 1920 and mentions that the Marines occupying Haiti and abusing its population mightily used the term to refer to Haitians. The U.S. troops had occupied Korea immediately after World War II and they defeated the Japanese, who had preceded them, called the Koreans gooks, as did those who followed them during the Korean War. In fact, the use of the term gook became so prevalent during the first months of the Korean War that General MacArthur tried to ban its use for fear that Asians would become alienated to the U.N. command because of the insult. A decade and a half later, gook was used to refer mainly to enemy combatants, the Viet Cong, as well as North Vietnamese soldiers during the war on Vietnam, but was also used to generally describe all Vietnamese by the American military. Senator John McCain, dear old John McCain, who was shot down and imprisoned after firing on Vietnamese from the air, used the word during the 1000 presidential campaign to refer to his former captors. I hate the gooks, said McCain. I will hate them as long as I live. I was referring to my prison guards, and I will continue to refer to them in language that might offend, end quote. Well, it was McCain attacking the Vietnamese. Could you imagine what would happen if the Vietnamese would try to bomb Arizona? Anyway, the use of this ugly racist term has not been limited to the American military. It was also employed by two other armies known for their disdain for people of color, the Rhodesians fighting to maintain white supremacy in what is today Zimbabwe, and by the Australians who fought alongside the Americans during the war in Vietnam. Well, next week, back in Washington, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, the official representative of the country that routinely and openly interferes in American elections, namely Israel, will hold its annual convention. More than half of the members of Congress hoping to suck up dollars from supporters of Israel will be there. And Vice President Mike Pence will also be there to pledge his loyalty to that foreign government. But on this Friday, there'll be another conference on the subject with a vastly different perspective. Titled The Israel Lobby and American Foreign Policy, it will feature, among others, Grant Smith of the Institute of Research, Middle East Policy, a frequent guest on this program, Hanan Ashrawi, a longtime Palestinian activist, and Israeli historian Ilan Pape. And it can be viewed live-streamed at IRMEP, that's I-R-M-E-P, IRMEP.org, from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific time this Friday. And you could also see the day's entire lineup of speakers at earmep.org. Don't miss it. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.